We're going to take a jump away for a little bit this morning from the book of Judges. I had planned to be there this morning, and that's kind of what I prepared for. So I'll ask an interest in your prayers, because I'm going to go somewhere else that my mind has been drawn to, and I think it'll make sense when we get there. So I'm going to take you over to a little book in the Old Testament. It's toward the end of the Old Testament, right before the book of Zechariah. It's a little book, one of my favorite in all the Bible. It's a little book called Haggai. I love this book. It's short. It's not very long, but I think it's just absolutely beautiful. And I think it's so critical to our time. Matter of fact, it's probably been an overriding theme, I guess, in some ways, of my ministry throughout the time that I've been trying to stand in pulpits around America. Now, this little book is the writing, if you will, of a prophet who lived at the tail end of the captivity of the children of Israel when they were carried into Babylon. You remember when they were overrun by the Babylonians, they didn't just get defeated; they got kidnapped, so to speak. They got carried off into Babylon. This is the captivity in which people like Daniel lived through. People like Meshach, Shadrach, and Abednego lived through. This is why they were in a land that wasn't their own, right? They were carried off to a foreign land. They were trained in the ways of that society. The Babylonians tried to steal, if you will, not just the possessions of the children of Israel, but the very fabric of their culture, right? They tried to re-educate them, tried to indoctrinate them in their ways. And the way they chose to do that was by taking the younger generation in particularly the fairest of that young class, those that appeared to be leaders amongst that generation, and train them in both the education and the culture of the Babylonian people. And they figured if they could capture the hearts and minds of those, then they would spread Babylonian culture throughout the children of Israel. We all know that didn't really work out quite the way they wanted to. If you remember, they tried to feed Daniel from the king's table, and Daniel said no. He said, "I'm not, you know, while my brethren are suffering, I'm not eating the king's meat. You feed me beans," right? And the keeper of those young men said, "I can't do that, because if I don't feed you from the king's table, and then 2 or 3 months down the road when I have to present you before the king, if you don't look healthy and fat, the king's going to know." And Daniel said, "Try me. Try me." And we all know how that worked out. Daniel and his cohorts that chose to not eat of the king's table, when the time came that they were presented before the king along with the other captors from other nations that Babylon had taken in, and they were trying to indoctrinate the others who chose to eat from the king's table, Daniel and his cohorts looked fairer and fatter than any of them, right? He was faithful to his God, and as a result, God honored him. That's a lesson we all need to learn. Whenever we're in that position of wanting to compromise or needing or maybe feeling like we need to compromise our faith, and we start to justify our thought process, we need to remember that we need to stand firm, because God will honor our choices. Don't ever think that God will penalize you for doing what's right. He's always there, and he's always there quickly to reassure and encourage. Okay? And that's kind of where this second chapter of the book of Haggai comes in. So Haggai, I'll use those two words interchangeably because I've never figured out the correct pronunciation. I've heard it both ways. I've listened to the Google pronunciation guides over and over again. I think it's Haggai. I'm not sure. But I'm not Hebrew, so let's just leave it at that, right? So here we are in the second chapter. This is on the tail end of the Babylonian captivity. Haggai and Zechariah along with Ezra and a few others, have come back to Israel, Jerusalem in particular, and their mandate is to rebuild the temple that was destroyed. Solomon's temple had been there before, and we all remember the grand stories about Solomon's temple. David wanted to build a temple. God said no because David was a man of war, right? And so David said, well, if I can't rebuild the temple, then I'm going to at least lay the groundwork for my son to do it. So he collected materials. He laid aside great finances. He had everything in place so that when Solomon came along, everything was in place for Solomon to build the temple. Solomon also acquired even more using his wisdom. He acquired much wealth in his time. And he was able to build a temple unto God that had an outward glory that was probably beyond anything the world had ever seen. If it were here today, it would be one of the great wonders of the world. Overlaid in gold, jewels everywhere. It's incredible. The descriptions were powerful. So here comes Haggai, Zechariah, Ezra, and the children of Israel who are coming out of captivity, traveling back from the east, right? Traveling west, traveling back from the east into the land of Israel to the city of Jerusalem, and they're trying to rebuild the temple. And if we read the first chapter, we know things didn't go real well at first. Read the first chapter, you find out that the people didn't really go about doing the job they were supposed to be doing. They built houses for themselves first. And the first part of Haggai's ministry was throwing down the gauntlet and challenging the people and telling them just how wrong they were for what they were doing. And apparently, this works. Apparently, this works. Because it says in chapter 2 that in the 7th month, in the 1 and 20th day of the month, came the word of the Lord by the prophet Haggai, saying, speak now to Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, governor of Judah, and to Joshua, the son of Josedech, the high priest, and to the residue of the people, saying, who is left among you that saw this house in her first glory, and how do you see it now? Is it not in your eyes in comparison of it as nothing? Now, this sounds horribly discouraging, but you have to keep reading. But at least right now, what I want you to understand is that apparently throwing down the gauntlet in that first part of Haggai's ministry worked because there was at least something to be compared to Solomon's temple. Right? And that's what he's talking about here. When you see this statement where it says, who is left among you that saw this house in her first glory, what he's saying is, who is here among the children of Israel that remembers the temple that Solomon built? Somebody in this congregation, he's saying, was alive and saw it firsthand. And then he's saying, now that you've got that picture in your head of what Solomon's temple looked like, I want you to look at what you've started. See, this is proof that they had that it worked because they had started the work. He says, I want you to look at it. I want you to ask yourself, how is this in comparison to that? And he says, regarding this, he says, is it not in your eyes in comparison of it as nothing? They certainly didn't have the resources that Solomon had. Matter of fact, if you go back to the first chapter, you'll find that the Lord told them to bring wood and go up and build the house. Take what you've got. Do the best you can. And that's what they were doing. They were laboring in the labor of the Lord. They were laboring in what God had instructed them to do. And they were doing the best that they could. But they were looking around and going, some of them were at least, the older folks who remembered Solomon's temple were looking around and going, this is awful. Matter of fact, if you go read Ezra, Ezra actually says that the older folks shed tears, they cried, and the younger folks celebrated and shouted. And they said the tumultuous sound was so great that you couldn't tell whether people were sad or happy. Because the old people remembered Solomon's temple and realized they couldn't build it back the way it was, and they felt like they were failing God. And the younger people had never had a temple, and they were just happy to have some place to worship God. And the mixture of those two was just so interesting. Now, it may seem like God is trying to discourage them at this point, but he is not. Like I said, you have to read on. He says, yet now, he says, be strong, O Zerubbabel, saith the Lord, and be strong, Joshua, the son of Josedech, the high priest, and be strong, all ye people of the land, saith the Lord, and work. He says, don't stop. Just because it doesn't look like what you think it should look like, he says, don't stop. Now, there's a good lesson in that for us. When we come into the house of God and we gather with God's people and we look around our churches and we say to ourselves, well, things may not look exactly like we think they should look like, but that is not reason to give up. God is calling on us to work. And he says to them something very, very significant. He says, work, for I am with you. I challenge you sometime to do a study on the number of times God says that throughout the Old Testament and the New, that he is either with us or he will be with us. It is God's primary means of encouragement for his people. His presence should be motivating to us. I would say that by far, the greatest sense of peace we have is when God is with us. And I do believe Brother Bill is 100% correct when the Bible speaks of peace, especially as it spoke of it there in that section of the book of Luke when Jesus was born, peace and goodwill toward men. It wasn't talking about what I would call horizontal peace. Peace between men, peace between countries, peace between political factions, peace between governments. It was talking about vertical peace. Peace between men and God. And it's through the ministry and work of Jesus Christ that that peace comes. And it's through the presence of God in our life that we experience that peace. Right? He says, listen, he says, I am with you, saith the Lord of hosts. He says, according to the word, verse 5, that I covenanted with you when you came out of Egypt, so my spirit remaineth among you, fear ye not. Now, I want you to know there's something that God does repeatedly throughout Scripture, and especially in the Old Testament, and I think he does it for us as well, and it's something that we need to remember. One of the things that God does over and over again is he reminds the children of Israel of what he has already done for them. And in their case, it's that exodus out of Egypt. That is the significant moment in their life. He tells them over and over again, am I not the God that brought you out of Egypt? Do you not remember coming out of Egypt? Do you not remember being brought up out of that land? And even along the way, God did things to try to remind them of that fact. Matter of fact, we remember that when the children of Israel crossed over the Jordan River into the land of Canaan, when they crossed over that river when it was at flood stage and everything looked dire, they're standing on this side and God had them carry, the priests carry, the Ark of the Covenant out on its stays, and they got out into the water just a little ways. The only thing that got wet was their feet, because once they got out into the water, God caused the water of the Jordan to pile up upstream and dry up downstream. The children of Israel were able to walk through that flooded plain of the Jordan River on dry ground. Now, that crossing of the Jordan River was so symbolic of their exodus out of Egypt. Now, I know the parting of the Red Sea was symbolic as well, but here we are. This is the moment that God had called upon them to be obedient to his word, to know that even though there were enemies in the land, that God would go before them and fight their battles. And he said, I want you to cross over. Now, they had failed once, but here they are the second time, and they're crossing over Jordan. And after they crossed, what did he have them do? Do you remember? He had them take stones and set up an altar. And he told them, he said, this altar wasn't necessarily for sacrificial purposes. He said it would be a memorial so that in the generations to come, as their children's children's children were born, and they would walk by this place and they would ask somebody, a parent, a grandparent, a great-grandparent, and say, what does that mean? That they would be able to relate the story again of God delivering them out of Egypt and across the Jordan. And then it would be a reminder to them that there was a God in heaven that loved them. Do you set up memorials in your life? Do you have them in your home? Do you have Bibles sitting on the table? Do you have things that, and places or even just moments in your life that you remember that are memorials that remind you of what God has done for you? Do you look back on certain events and times? And do you relate those stories to your children, to your children's children, to one another, to remind one another of just how powerful God is in our life? We all have them. The question is, what do we do with them? Do we just file them away and forget about them? Or do we actually bring them back as God does here, where he says, according to the word I covenanted with you when you came out of Egypt, so my spirit remaineth among you, fear ye not. In other words, just as I was with you then, I am with you now. Because you see, the God that we serve is the same yesterday, today, and forevermore. So when somebody, for instance, as an example, when somebody comes to the place that they feel that they can commit themselves to the Lord and they submit themselves and ask for a home in the church, there's such a moment there. Man, it's such a place to build a memorial, isn't it? And we take and we baptize them. I try to remind that person or try to tell that person that one of the things, and if I haven't told you that, I'm telling you that now, okay? That's a moment you need to mark. If you don't actually build a physical memorial, at least build a mental one. Because there's going to be times in your life when challenges are going to come and you're going to question whether God is real and you're going to question whether your faith is real. And when that time comes, you need to let your heart and your mind drift back to that moment. When something powerful happened, when you were moved in such a way that you were willing to stand before God's people and allow an old preacher to bury you in water. What brought you there? Remember that. Remember that feeling. Remember that moment. Remember what it took. And know this, that the same God that led you through that water is still with you today. That's what he's saying here. He's saying, listen, just as I was with you when you crossed out of Jordan, I am with you today. He says, for thus saith the Lord of hosts. He says, yet once, it is a little while, and he says, I will shake the heavens and the earth and the sea and the dry land. Does anybody want to hazard a guess on when this happened? It's the first coming of Jesus Christ. What we might refer to as the first advent or the birth of our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ. He shook it all. He says, yet once is a little while, I will shake the heavens and the earth and the sea and the dry land. And he says, and I will shake all nations, And then he says this. This is sort of the key to me to understanding what it's talking about. He says, and the desire of all nations shall come. Now, we live in an interesting time. And I guarantee you right now, there's not much that could come into the world that would satisfy as being the desire of all nations. We have nations in this world that are so contradictorily opposed, I don't even know if that's a word, to one another, that they would not find joy in anything. I mean, even within our own nation, we can't find common ground, it seems like today, on things we would agree upon as being good or right. But the Bible tells us that God has a people in every nation, tribe, kindred, and tongue that has ever existed or ever will exist upon this planet. So Jesus Christ is the only thing I know of that could adequately be described as being the desire of all nations. There is a people within every nation, whether they understand it or not, Jesus is their desire. He is their hope. It is Christ in you, the hope of glory. Every born-again child of grace desires Jesus. If not externally, certainly internally. That new creature that has been made within them, that is them, desires Jesus. It may not know his name, or we may not know his name, but there's a desire within us to be drawn to that which is righteous and good. In that moment, we've been given faith. Every single child of grace is born of the Spirit of God, has the possession of faith, and the object of that faith is Jesus Christ. Right? So the desire of all nations, he said, the desire of all nations will come. So what is the prophet pointing to? He's pointing to the first coming of Jesus Christ. Now don't forget, we're still in this context here where we have people that know what the temple that Solomon built looked like. And we've got people that are working on the new one. And what God has told them is, look, how do they compare? They don't. I mean, I guess the best description I can give you, I've used it before, is they're looking at what they're doing, and compared to what Solomon did, this is just a little two-room shack. An inner and an outer chamber, a place for the veil to go. But largely, in comparison of what was there before, he says, it is as nothing. And this isn't just Haggai's words. This is God's words. It is as nothing. But he says, listen, I'm with you. And I'm with you just like I was when I brought you out of the land of Egypt. I'm with you just like I was when you went through the Red Sea. I'm with you just like I was when you went through the Jordan River. I've not turned my back. I'm still here. And he says, listen, just as I was with you then, you need to understand that it's not too far into the future. And it wasn't too far into the future at this point. He said, it's not too far into the future. He says, where I will shake the heavens. There is a very significant event coming. It's an event so significant that even the calendars of every nation in the world turn on this one event. The birth of Jesus Christ. They can change the names if they want to of that counting of years after Christ and before. They can do whatever they want. But the reality is that the zero point on their calendar, no matter what they name it, still turns on the life of Jesus Christ. It is what it is. And it's not going to change, right? He says, I will shake all nations and the desire of all nations shall come. And then he says this. This is interesting. He says, I will fill this house with glory, saith the Lord of hosts. Solomon's temple was glorious on the outside. God says the temple you're building is going to be glorious from the inside. He says, I'm going to fill it with glory. He says, the silver is mine and the gold is mine. In other words, what he's saying is the materials of construction are irrelevant. He said, what Solomon did, he did with what was mine. Wasn't his, he didn't give it to me. He wasn't giving it to me in any material way. I owned all the materials that Solomon used to build that temple, just as he owns all the materials you have in your life today. You're simply stewards of what God has given you. It's a principle we all need to start understanding a little better. Because I'm afraid that as time has went on, we have forgotten how to be stewards of what God has given us. I know I have. But he says, the silver is mine, and the gold is mine, saith the Lord of hosts. He says, I'll fill this house with glory. And listen to what he says. He says, the glory of this latter house, the temple you're building right now, he says, the glory of this latter house shall be greater than that of the former. Now that was unimaginable for them. They couldn't imagine that fact. They're sitting here looking at this little shack that they're building out of wood and remembering some of the older folks are describing to them what Solomon's temple looked like, the size, the grandeur of it, and they're going, that's just not possible. And then God says to them through the prophet, listen, the glory of this house, this little wooden two-room shack, is going to be greater than that of Solomon's temple. Now, how can that be possible? Because as you go over to the New Testament and you begin to read about the life of Jesus Christ, you come across an event where Jesus is in the temple and he unrolls a scroll and he begins to read out of the book of Isaiah, where it presents a story of the coming Messiah being altogether prophet, priest, and king. And then he says to them in that moment, he says, this day, is this prophecy fulfilled in your ears? So why is it, how is it that the glory of that house would be greater than that of the former? It's because in that place, Jesus himself, the very Son of God, the God-man, would declare the gospel in that building. That's something Solomon's temple could never claim. Furthermore, in the coming days after that, men like Paul and Peter and James and John and Thomas and Matthew and others would come along and come there every time the people of God met, and they would declare Jesus the Savior of sinners. The gospel of peace would be preached in that building, and the glory of that place would be greater than that of Solomon's. Isn't that incredible? Because you see, it's not the materials of construction that matters. In other words, it's not what we have that matters. It's that we do the best we can with what we have, and we trust God for the rest. Because you see, the blessings that God can bestow upon it are greater than our skill. I'm not naive. I read stories, and I've read history. They say that when Charles Haddon Spurgeon, the great prince of preachers in England, would go out into the public fair, he would find a hillside and just begin to preach. And they say that when he did, at times, 10 to 20,000 people would gather to hear him in the open air. I'm confident that if I found a hillside here in Dallas, Georgia, or even if I went to a more concentrated, populated area like Atlanta, I could start preaching, and I'm pretty sure I wouldn't get that many. I'm pretty sure the numbers would be small. And I'm not so sure the numbers of those trying to shut me up wouldn't be larger than those that wanted to hear it. I have no qualms about the fact that my gift of preaching the gospel, that my gift when it comes to delivering the word of God is probably nowhere on par with that of somebody like Charles Spurgeon. I don't doubt that I can't preach the way Jonathan Edwards did when he was on the frontiers of America. And he was declaring the sovereignty of God and the depravity of man in ways that are just incredible. I'm confident that the frontier preachers that moved across this country, that constituted church after church after church as the wave of people began across our nation, I'm confident that the gifts of those men were greater than mine. I mean, I've read their writings. If they preached the way they wrote, they're smarter than I can ever imagine to be. I spent a good deal of time studying the writings of others like John Gill and reading what they wrote and knowing how intellectually inferior I am. I have no qualms about the fact of standing here today being just like those folks in the time of Haggai saying, I do not have the skills nor the gifts that the church had before. But that's not an excuse to stop the labor. That's not a reason to give up. That's not a time to go home. No, it's a time to remember that what God told these people was to bring wood, go up to the mountain, and build the house. Take what you've got, bring your gifts, whatever God has given you, and labor and work. Because listen to what he says. He says, the glory of this latter house shall be greater than of the former, saith the Lord of hosts. And then he says this, and in this place, in this house, he says, will I give peace. In this place will I give peace. What did God give in that place? Well, it was the place where he presented his son. It was the place where the gospel first rang out. It was there that peace came. I think about the time that the times over and over again on the Day of Atonement, when the children of Israel, especially when they were faithful, when they would gather around the temple or the tabernacle, when the high priest once a year would carry a sacrifice into the holiest of holies, not without blood for himself, but he would carry a sacrifice in for the people. And the people are concerned. The tenor of their coming year would hinge upon this moment. Would God accept their offering? And they would gather outside and they would wait. Now, as I understand it, the high priest would go in and he had this robe that he wore, the ephod that he wore on the outside. He had this robe that had bells and pomegranates around the bottom, so everywhere he walked, he jingled. You know, I can't imagine having to deal with that, but that's the way it was. It always reminds me of the old, I know it's probably sacrilege to think this way, but it always reminds me of the old Andy Griffith show where they had the shoplifter in the local store and they couldn't figure it out. And Barney had tried to arrest about 20 different people from what I remember. None of them were the right person. And then all of a sudden they're out on the sidewalk and Barney and Andy starts telling everybody, be quiet, watch out for a minute. And he takes this little old lady and the mayor is just livid, and the owner of the store is just distraught. He's accusing a little old lady of being the robber. And then finally he grabs her coat and opens it up, and there's just, you know, pots and pans and silverware hanging in there. And they asked him, they said, Andy, how did you know? He said, well, a little while ago, I was walking through that store, and I bumped into her, and she jingled. He said, a little old lady ought not to jingle. That's how he knew. You know, the high priest, he'd have those bells and pomegranates. He'd walk, and everywhere he walked, it made noise. Now, as I understand it, and I might be wrong, but as I understand it, when he would go in that one time a year, he would enter into the outer room, and he would remove that ephod, and everything would go quiet. And it reminds me of when Jesus was on the cross and darkness fell. Darkness fell. Everything would go quiet. Nobody knew what was going on. He would go in and do whatever he was supposed to do inside there. And we know the requirement. If God did not accept the sacrifice, the high priest would die inside. But if God accepted the sacrifice, the high priest would come back out of the veil, and he would pick the ephod up off the floor or wherever he laid it, put it back on. Now, when he would do that, what would happen? It'd start to make a lot of noise, right? And the people outside, especially in the days when it was a tabernacle, they could hear that. And I don't know how it worked, but I just can imagine the people gathered around. The people up front could hear, and they would start turning to their neighbors behind them in the crowd saying, "The high priest lives." And that news would travel throughout Israel. Why? Because the fact that the high priest lived was proof that God had accepted the sacrifice, and they could look forward to the pleasure and peace of knowing that things had been made right. What do you think those bells and pomegranates represent? I'll tell you. It's the gospel. Because as soon as Jesus comes forth from the tomb, as soon as he came out of the veil after he had given himself, given his life for us, and went into the grave, he comes out of the veil, if you will. As soon as he comes out of there alive, and as soon as the disciples, the apostles, the sisters in the church saw him and understood who he was, as soon as Thomas stood there that day, and Jesus said, "Thomas, here are my hands and my feet and my side. Do what thou must." And Thomas said, "My Lord and my God." Oh, they began to go from place to place, and they began to preach the gospel of Jesus Christ. Do you see it? The bells began to beat against the pomegranates. And for 2,000 years, the message has been one and one alone. And that is this: the high priest lives. Why is that so important? Because it establishes something. It establishes that Jesus made peace between us and God. And it was in that house that they were building in the days of Haggai that that message began. And it began in the appearance and person of Jesus, who stood there and read from the book of Isaiah. Yes, Jesus is our peace. We can experience that peace through faith and obedience and love. We can experience that peace as we live here. The peace that the angels were speaking of, just like Brother Bill said, it's not about the lack of war. It's not about the lack of conflict. Matter of fact, Jesus said, "I didn't come to give that kind of peace at all." He said, "I came to divide. I came to sit mother against father, children against parents. I came to tell you that you need to be faithful unto me, even if it means the loss of your family, the loss of relationships. I came with a sword," right? But he also came to bring peace, just not that kind of peace. He came to bring peace between us and God. A vertical peace, not a horizontal one. Matter of fact, we're told repeatedly throughout the Bible that as long as time lasts, Christians are not going to be popular. And if we are, we're doing it wrong. We're not going to be popular. This is not going to be a generally accepted practice or message in the world. It's a message the world will fight. And just because things look bleak at times, or just because we don't think we have what we should have, or just because we don't have the gifts that we used to have, or just because we don't have this or that, doesn't mean we stop. It means we continue to labor, because the God that brought us through the waters of baptism is the same God that is with us today. We can build those memorials and go back to them and remind us of who God is. And there, in Him, we'll find peace.